This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's this whole thing in America that, you know, consuming lots of energy is sort of macho in the American way, and that any kind of conservation or efficiency thing is sort of sissy policy, and, you know, that you're just a sort of doofus in a cardigan sweater if you suggest anyone should use less energy and impinge on our God-given right to burn all the oil and coal and gas we want.
If you could get the president's attention for just long enough to tell him the 10 things you'd like him to do to save the planet, or at least put us on a more sustainable path, what would you say? Today on Sea Change Radio, we talk with environmental author and journalist Jeff Goodell. He expounds on his list, recently published in Rolling Stone magazine, of the 10 things President Obama could do now without having to wrestle with Congress, which would have a significant positive environmental impact. He also shares a small bit of the wisdom contained in his 2006 book, Big Coal, helping debunk the myth of clean coal, elucidating the perils of mountaintop removal coal mining, and discussing the role that railroad companies play in energy prices in the United States. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is journalist Jeff Goodell. His latest book is How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering and the Audacious Quest to Fix Earth's Climate. He's also written national bestsellers like Big Coal, and he is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. Jeff, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So first, let's dive into your latest piece for Rolling Stone. It's entitled 10 Things Obama Must Do, How the President Can Fulfill His Pledge to Protect the Environment Without Waiting for Congress. Without me giving all 10 of those away, why don't you talk about the ones that you think are the most realistic for us to see happen, and then some of the ones which are maybe politically more challenging?
Well, you know, this idea for this list came about because, you know, it's clear that Obama's not going to get anything through Congress because of, you know, the House of Representatives basically wants to dismantle environmental protections and, you know, kind of is going after clean energy, as we've seen in this latest scandal about the solar company Solyndra. But I think that there's a lot that he could do that doesn't require congressional approval and that he could do on his own if he really wanted to. So I have the list of 10 of these ideas. You know, the first one, the most obvious one, and the kind of most high-profile one is stopping this Keystone pipeline that is coming down from the tar sands in Alberta to bring tar sands oil to Gulf Coast refineries. That's a big problem because tar sands oil is much more carbon intensive than conventional oil. And so if we're really going to take, you know, climate change seriously, we can't be bringing in, you know, millions of gallons of this sort of dirty fuel from the north. And that's something he can, doesn't require congressional approval, just basically a State Department waiver because it's a pipeline across international boundaries. And so this is something that, you know, a decision he can make. You know, does he want this or this pipeline to happen or does he not? That's one example. Another example is implementing some of the rules and regulations that were suggested by the Oil Spill Commission after the BP oil spill in the Gulf. Not much has been done to really reform offshore oil drilling to make it safer, cleaner, less likely to have another explosion like we saw in the Gulf last year. And that has not much has been done with that. He could do that, implement some of those suggestions. Some of the other things are pass tougher EPA regulations on coal ash disposal. It's been hung up in the EPA for a very long time. This is essentially a kind of hazardous waste that is not being safely dealt with, and he could do that by just pushing the EPA to issue new regulations. And I think finally, you know, I won't go through them all, but I think the biggest thing is simply using the bully pulpit more. He has, you know, basically not mentioned the phrase climate change except for more than a handful of times, and really hasn't put much political weight or energy behind the whole idea of dealing with what I think is the biggest challenge of our time, which is climate change and rebuilding our energy infrastructure. And he hasn't really done much about that, even rhetorically. And I think that that's something that he could obviously do, is speak more forthrightly and courageously about these issues.
If you were a advisor to the president and worrying about re-election issues, which one of these has the greatest political risk and which one is just a low-hanging fruit?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess the one that has the greatest political risk, and but is also the one with the greatest political payoff, is the idea of using the bully pulpit more, of actually talking, engaging directly about climate change, actually arguing for the science of climate change, talking about how robust it is, you know, trying to really shut down the sort of denial industry in America on climate issues. You know, he's basically been trying to just not talk about it and run what some people in the White House call a stealth campaign, which is to go after carbon pollution indirectly by doing things like raising fuel efficiency standards, things like that, that are certainly worthwhile doing and certainly do have an impact on the amount of carbon pollution that goes into the atmosphere, but don't require a kind of front-end battle over climate change. I think it's, you know, the riskiest thing that he could do would be to actually bring this up and actually deal with it in a straightforward way. But I also think it's what really needs to be done. There needs to be a sort of public political dialogue about what to do about our energy and climate problems. And that's the one thing that he's really failed to do. The no-brainer things, some of the things like making sure that the loopholes in the fuel efficiency standards for vehicles called CAFE standards remain tight. That's something. I think launching and pushing for a national energy efficiency campaign, you know, pushing for higher efficiency standards for appliances, pushing for reduction in electricity and fuel use in federal buildings and with federal vehicles and things like that is pretty much a sort of no-brainer.
Sorry to interrupt, but it seemed like he was going down that path with efficiency, and then he immediately backed off after being mocked for saying that people should check their air pressure in their car tires, which actually would be a very prudent thing to do, but he didn't want to be lumped in with Jimmy Carter, who, God forbid, wore a sweater and put solar panels on the White House.
Right, and, you know, there's this whole thing in America that, you know, consuming lots of energy is sort of macho in the American way, and that any kind of conservation or efficiency thing is sort of
wimpy,
you know, sissy policy, and you know, that you're just a sort of doofus in a cardigan sweater if you suggest anyone should use less energy and impinge on our God-given right to burn all the oil and coal and gas we want. So, you know, but he could break through that. That's a very 70s point of view. And I think that if this were intelligently positioned, and he would talk about national security implications with foreign oil imports and, you know, economic interests with, you know, pushing for green energy, clean tech energy. There's lots of ways you could make this work that, you know, would dodge the Jimmy Carter problem.
In this Rolling Stone piece, your first proposal listed is to stop the Keystone Pipeline. What do you think will ultimately happen with the pipeline, though?
I think they're going to approve it. I think that you know, it's environmentalists and activists are trying to draw a line in the sand in this. There was a big protest rally in Washington, D.C. organized by Bill McKibben's organization, 350.org, that got several thousand protesters there over a couple of weeks. And I think 65 or so people went to jail, including NASA climate scientist Jim Hansen and others who were involved in this. But, you know, I think that ultimately the administration doesn't want to play politics with this, doesn't want to play politics with gas prices and oil shortages. There's a lot of money behind this. This is a multi-billion dollar project. And they will try to appease environmentalists and progressive voters another way. So that my guess, and I may be wrong, and I hope I'm wrong, is that he'll approve this, but offer some other carrot to the environmental and progressive forces that are going to be really unhappy and disappointed about this.
You mentioned pardoning Tim DeChristopher, the activist who he was found guilty of civil disobedience in a bid for national park territory in Utah. Do you think pardoning DeChristopher would be one of those low-hanging fruits or an easy bone to throw to the left wing of his party, and but would actually be more of a symbol that he's fighting for them than actually having to take on the more moneyed interests?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see him pardon Tim DeChristopher, because I think it's a tragedy and a farce what's happened to Tim for what he did, and I'd love to see him out of jail. I think, though, that it's politically risky for him to do this, simply because it would just kick up a lot of political dust. I think that it would be seen to be very high profile. It would be seen as siding with radical environmentalists, which Tim is not by any stretch of the imagination, but that's how it would be played politically. It would just be Fox News would have a field day with it. I just don't think that's a very smart political calculus for the administration to make, even though I would be happy if he made it.
This song is called Hurricane. If you got any political pull at all, maybe you can help us get this man out of jail, back onto the streets.
Shots ring out on a barroom night. Enter Betty Valentine from the outer hall. She sees a bartender and a pool of blood. Has that, my God, they've killed them all. Here comes the story of the hurricane, the man the authorities came to blame for something that he never done. Put in a prison cell, but one time he could have been the champion of the world.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Jeff Goodell. He's a contributing editor for Rolling Stone, as well as the author of books such as Big Coal and How to Cool the Planet. Jeff, you write in your recent Rolling Stone piece that one of the things that the Obama administration needs to do is to, quote, make coal clean up its mess. Can you unpack that for us?
Well, that phrase is referring to coal ash disposal, which is, as I mentioned earlier, a huge problem in America. I mean, most people know about coal ash because of the Kingston spill right at in late December of 2008, where a coal ash disposal pond in Tennessee near a big coal plant collapsed and sent all this sludge down the rivers there, and it was hugely covered in the media, and you saw these houses floating in this black sludge and things. But so it's a huge problem. You know, when you burn coal, it's like when you burn something in your fireplace, it creates ashes, and that ash has to be disposed of. And the problem with coal is that it's got a lot of heavy metals in it, like arsenic and mercury and cadmium and selenium and things like that, nasty stuff. So far, for the last 100 years or so, basically, it's been more or less unregulated, except by some state regulations, and stuff's been dumped everywhere. And it gets into water aquifers, drinking water aquifers, drinking water supply, and it's really nasty stuff. This can be fixed. It just requires that the stuff be dumped into lined ponds, like other kinds of toxic wastes are, and done and monitored and things like that. But the industry doesn't want to do that because it's more expensive. So the industry's been fighting this. So that's one thing that, you know, the administration could do that would really have a lot of public health benefits, and it would really be an easy call for them. I mean, they had this disaster, you know, just as Obama was taking over, which Lisa Jackson was, you know, very involved with and paid close attention to. There's no reason that they should be dragging their feet on this kind of thing. But there's other things, too, related to coal's mess, such as mercury pollution. Rules on mercury pollution are still being held back. This ozone pollution rule I mentioned had a lot to do with the coal industry. And then the big kahuna for coal that the administration is also punting on is doing anything about, you know, CO2 pollution. CO2 is the main greenhouse gas, and coal is the biggest single point source of CO2 emissions in the country. But they've done nothing to crack down on that, either with a cap and trade program like the administration, passed in Congress in the early days of the administration, or putting what are called performance standards, like California has, on power plant emissions, so that you say, okay, you can build a coal plant, but it has to, you know, you can only emit this amount of CO2 per megawatt of electricity. And that's something that the administration has been primed to do and has been set up to do, but has been delaying and delaying and delaying.
Your book, Big Coal, is a terrific overview of where things were in the coal industry at 2006. Since then, you've also had an excellent profile of Don Blankenship, the CEO of Massey Industries. If you were to come out with an updated edition in 2011, what kind of things do you think readers would be most surprised by?
Well, basically that they're still around and that nothing has changed. You know, that when I wrote that book in 2006, it looked like, you know, there was going to be, that we were taking global warming seriously, that, you know, it was seen as a problem the Bush administration obviously didn't want to deal with because of their connections with the oil industry and things like that. But there was this perception that, you know, once the election, the presidential election of 2008 happened, either one of the candidates, McCain or Obama, both of them were talking very seriously about doing something about CO2 pollution and beginning to address this problem of climate change. And it seemed that, you know, something was going to happen on this issue, that we were going to have some kind of a cap and trade system or a carbon tax or something, and that this would be sort of, once Bush was gone, this would be dealt with forthrightly. What's happened is, you know, stunning to everyone. It's not only obviously Bush is gone, but not only have we not made any progress, we're basically going backwards in the wrong direction. You know, we have all this, you know, hoodoo voodoo stuff about is climate science real and all that kind of a thing. And, you know, we're farther than ever we're farther than we were when I wrote the book from doing anything about the central problem of coal, which is, you know, CO2 pollution.
And as you predict in the book, the money that was being spent on the quote unquote clean coal campaign has worked. I mean, it's part of our language, whether we know what it means or not. And as you write, clean coal is not an actual invention, a physical thing. It's an advertising slogan like fat-free donuts or interest-free loans. Give our listeners a little bit more of an idea of what the clean coal campaign is really all about.
Well, the clean coal campaign is something, you know, I'm sure that all your listeners, anybody who's listening to this, has probably seen these clean coal ads that have been running, you know, basically for the last couple of years, especially during political campaigns and things. That, you know, are these sort of highly slickly produced ads that tout how clean coal has become. And it's a, you know, very clever advertising slogan cooked up by a Madison Avenue advertising group. And it's, you know, the goal is to convince Americans that, you know, coal, dirty coal is something like, you know, their grandfather's Buick, you know, that's something the grandpa thought about. But now in the new world, we have all this new technology. And coal is, you know, clean now. We fixed coal. And, you know, it's just, it's a great campaign because it plays into all of our naivete about energy, and it plays into our sort of Yankee faith that technology can fix anything.
Right.
But it's complete nonsense. You know, it's true that the levels of pollution from conventional chemicals that cause smog, such as sulfur dioxide and things like that, have declined in new coal plants. But that's only because the Clean Air Act has forced them to lower emissions. And that Clean Air Act is not something that the coal industry embraced. In fact, they fought it tooth and nail and hired squads of lawyers complaining that if they had to reduce smog pollution, it would destroy the American economy and kill the coal industry. Of course, it didn't happen that way at all. But more importantly, this idea of clean coal has nothing to do with all the other problems of coal, such as mountaintop removal mining, this practice of mining in Appalachia that is blasting away the mountains because the coal has been so mined out there that the only way to economically get after it is to blast away the mountains and dig the coal out that way. Hugely destructive, hugely controversial, a real kind of scar on the national landscape, and it's really flattening large parts of of West Virginia. I remember being in West Virginia when I was working on my book with a very well-known coalfield activist who'd seen her family's home place destroyed by mountaintop removal mines. And her name was Judy Bonds. And we walked up to this mountaintop removal mine, and she sort of, you know, we looked down into this pit, this scar, this, you know, devastation. And she sort of stamped her feet on the ground and said, "I don't care if there's marshmallows coming out of that smokestacks, there's blood on this coal." And so by that she means that, you know, this coal mining is really, especially this mountaintop removal mining, is really devastating to large parts of America, certainly Appalachia, where it's most prominent. But the other part about clean coal, too, that is not considered is, you know, carbon dioxide pollution. You know, coal is the single largest point source of carbon dioxide pollution in America. It's responsible for about 40% of the CO2, man-made CO2 that goes into the atmosphere. And as NASA scientist Jim Hansen has said many times, we don't have a prayer of having a stable climate in the future if we don't reduce our use of coal. The coal, by, you know, his measure and by most measures, is the central problem when it comes to getting a handle on greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, none of that is referred to when we talk about clean coal.
I'm sick and tired of your dirty tricks. Move on, you make me so mad I could kill a brain. Running around, you better stop it quick. This is the last time you get away. Can't run, you can't hide, you won't get away. You will treat me just in your way. Quit, you better quit. Sick and tired of your dirty tricks. Chicken, chicken, stretching chicken and bass and mean, and you better quit. Quit it, you better quit.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Jeff Goodell. He's a contributing editor for Rolling Stone, as well as the author of books such as Big Coal and How to Cool the Planet. You mentioned in your book, Big Coal, about the power of the railroads, and that moving all this coal all around the country makes the railroads some of the most important players in the energy industry. What we never hear about the railroad industry money or campaigns in terms of coal or any other kind of involvement that they have in fighting against regulations. Can you give us an update on that?
The railroads are hugely important in this sort of, you know, energy politics and energy industry in America. And they're, of course, particularly important with coal, because that is how coal is moved, how it gets from the coal mine to the power plant. In a few places along the, in the Ohio River Valley and things, there's a lot of coal barges and coal is transported that way. But by and large, most of the coal in America is shifted around on railroads. And as the mining in Appalachia has declined, and the mining in West Virginia, I mean, in Wyoming, where there's these huge coal reserves, 70, 80, 200, 300 foot seams of coal sitting out there, the railroads have become even more and more important, as you have what amounts to this giant conveyor belt that's going around the country from Wyoming out to the East Coast, across the Mississippi and back again, circulating millions of tons of coal. For my book, I rode some of these coal trains. You know, these trains are amazing. They're like a mile and a half long, and just car after car after car of coal that's being carried out to these big power plants on the in the East Coast.
Yeah, if you've ever been trying to cross the street in a car and then all of a sudden a coal train comes in your way, that's how you get an idea how long these things actually are.
Yeah, it's really amazing. You know, and you know, for some of these big coal plants, like the ones that I visited in Georgia, you know, they require one of these big mile and a half long trains, one a day, to keep the coal supply. That's how much they burn. Is basically one and a half sometimes of these big coal trains every day. So it's this huge conveyor belt that has to be rolling and rolling and rolling all the time to keep these power plants fueled up. And it's become a huge source of revenue for for the railroads. But for example, I rode the Burlington Northern Santa Fe trains, and you know, I think about 50% of their revenues now comes from hauling coal. So they're a huge player in this. And right now, one of the big controversies, in fact, that's connected with the West Coast, is that, you know, there's a lot of coal in Wyoming right now that just can't get out because building railroad tracks is really expensive, especially for coal, which have to be these extra super duper tracks because the coal trains are so heavy. And they've done all kinds of things to automate the coal trains, but they can only get so much coal to the East Coast out of Wyoming. That's a big bottleneck for the growth of the coal industry. But what's happening now is they're trying to get a line from Wyoming west into Washington State, which will then be exporting coal and sending it places like China. And this is going to be one of the big sort of looming fights in the near future, is a building of a coal transport terminal in Washington, and then the building of this railroad across Wyoming to handle this coal. So the problem with the Wyoming coal now is it's landlocked, and you know, the virtue for the railroads is that, you know, if someone's going to carry it out of Wyoming, it's going to be them, and it's an immensely profitable business to be in.
So have the railroads been in hand holding, or have the railroads been in partnership with big coal trying to keep regulations in their favor, or have they been more just worried about the details of trying to get this port in Washington set up and just focusing on their own interests?
Oh, no. I mean, they're a big player in, you know.
I'm talking in terms of lobbying and things like that.
Right. No, they're a huge, powerful force in lobbying to kill you know, cap and trade legislation that was, you know, trying to be struggling through the House and the Senate, you know, 2 years ago. They've been outspoken always in their opposition to any kind of regulations that would hurt the coal industry. Although they don't take a public view, a public role in the same way that they're not running clean coal ads and things like that. They're not a public face of this, but in Washington and in the background, they're a hugely powerful force. And of course, you know, railroads are the, you know, original monopoly in America, and they are very, very deeply wired into the political structures, not only of Washington, but even the states where they operate.
And yet they're a symbol of the future as well, because they're mass transit solutions where other countries have adopted and been much more successful trying to get their populations to use mass transit, and rail is a great alternative for that when it comes to moving people. But if you juxtapose that with what is really filling the coffers of railroad companies, it's shipping coal all around the country, and now if they get their way around the world.
Right, and there's a big difference between, you know, the commercial haulers like Burlington Northern Santa Fe and the, you know, regional people haulers, you know, who are doing, you know, Amtrak, which is, of course, you know, state-run,
but in terms of the messaging, though, you could see how they could piggyback on some of that goodwill in the green jobs movement to try to get what they need to do to move that coal around.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, it's hilarious, in fact, because, for example, when I was riding some of the coal trains, they would, some of the locomotives that were, these particular ones were made by GE, and they had, like, you know, slogans on the side about how efficient these new engines were, you know, and the lower greenhouse gas emissions of these new locomotives that they were using
to move coal around,
to haul hundreds of, you know, millions, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds of tons of coal. They're using, you know, fuel efficient locomotives. I mean, it's the embodiment of the insanity of our, you know, energy system.
Yeah, well, that is, and I'm glad that people like you are able to continue to expose it. Jeff Goodell, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Great, thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past to find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Miles Davis, Bob Dylan, and the Sweet Inspirations. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists. Go to Sungevity.com to learn more. Check out our website at SeaChangeRadio.com. That's SEAChangeRadio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. and tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.